Today is Friday, February 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the doctor who first raised the alarm over the new coronavirus in China has died.
Had the authorities tried to act on that piece of information rather than detaining him, shutting him up, then we wouldn't have this epidemic, which has killed more than 600 people in China now.
Plus, rising tensions between Syria and Turkey over the last rebel stronghold, and a look at this weekend's Academy Awards from Hollywood. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, Turkey is facing a looming crisis over Syria's rebel-held Idlib province as Damascus forces advance on the enclave. Turkey warns of a humanitarian crisis with hundreds of thousands of refugees on its border. Turkey is deploying military enforcements, raising the risk of clashes with Syrian forces. But Ankara will be wary of any confrontation given Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's Russian support. Idlib could pose the biggest challenge to recent Turkish-Russian rapprochement. For more, International Edition's Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul earlier today.
Syrian forces are continuing their advance against rebels in Idlib, which is the last stronghold of rebel opposition, home to around 3 million people. We understand that the Syrian forces have captured this strategically important town of Sarakep after intense fighting on Thursday, and they are now in the position of strengthening their position there. Now, there are four Turkish military outposts around that town, and that was part of an agreement with Moscow that goes back to 2018, and whereby 12 military outposts were created to create a de-escalation zone to prevent fighting between the rebels and Syrian forces. Now, that deal has all but collapsed given these latest advances, and Turkish forces now find themselves surrounded by regime forces. And that follows a deadly encounter on Monday in which 8 Turkish soldiers were killed by Syrian regime artillery fire. And that response resulted in a deadly retaliation by Turkish forces, with the Turkish Defense Minister, Hulusi Akar, saying they killed dozens of Syrian regime soldiers in 50 attacks, with the warning that if Turkish forces are again attacked, then there will be further retaliations.
What are Turkey's primary concerns, and what is it doing about this situation?
Well, Turkey has a number of concerns. Primarily, it fears that this Idlib province is finally overrun by government forces. This will precipitate another massive humanitarian crisis. Already, according to President Erdogan, the latest fighting has seen over a million Syrians fleeing towards Turkey's border. Within the latest reports in the last few days, another 90,000 have joined that million or so people massed around Turkey's border. And Erdogan has said, with the country hosting over 3.5 million Syrians since the start of the civil war, the country cannot take any more. And it's saying that this will only be not only Turkey's problem, but it will also be Europe's problem as well. Remember that many refugees have moved from Turkey into Europe, causing a major crisis in Europe as well. And it's also a major security problem because it's widely believed that there are tens of thousands of jihadists in Idlib as well. They too potentially could pose a major problem in security-wise in Turkey as well. Turkey has suffered from attacks blamed on jihadists and Islamic State organizations in the past. That's why they are determined, they say, to prevent Damascus from overrunning Idlib. Now, what Turkey can do is a big problem because even though they have military on the ground in Idlib, the Russians control the airspace, and military analysts and experts are warning that any sustained operation against Damascus forces would require air support, and that would put Turkish military planes at risk of being shot down by Russian missile systems. And that's going to be a key point of discussions when Russian and Turkish diplomats sit down this weekend.
But the two governments are on different sides. Russia and Turkey have different positions. Is there any middle ground for them? What do they hope to accomplish with these talks?
Well, that's right. From the very beginning of the civil war, Ankara has been backing the rebels, and Moscow has been one of the staunchest supporters of Damascus. Now, despite those differences, the two sides have in the last few years been working together. And what was the impetus for that was that a Turkish jet shot down a Russian bomber way back in 2015 operating in Syria. That brought a crisis between Turkey and Russia in its bilateral relations. And I think both sides realized that it was better to work together than to and to control the situation than risk another crisis in ties. And that's been very successful. And Moscow is believed to be pressing Ankara to say, you've got to start talking with Damascus. Turkey cut its relations with Damascus at the beginning of the civil war. Moscow has said that you've got to start talking to Damascus. Ankara has ruled that out, saying it will not talk with Damascus. But I think there will be a lot of pressure from Moscow saying this is a way out of this crisis.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul speaking earlier to International Edition's Kate Pound Dawson. Rwandan man applied for citizenship in the United States has been arrested and charged with providing false information about his participation in the country's 1994 genocide. The U.S. Department of Justice said that Idrissa Gasana should not have been allowed to become a U.S. citizen because he allegedly participated in the killings. Gasana is being held in custody and will have a hearing on February 11th. And in Australia, heavy rains lashed parts of the wildfire and drought-stricken eastern coast on Friday, bringing flooding in Sydney, but relief to firefighters dealing with dozens of blazes in the New South Wales state. The state has been hardest hit by wildfires that have killed at least 33 and destroyed more than 3,000 homes in an unprecedented fire season that began late in a record dry 2019. Officials were optimistic the rain will help extinguish some blazes over the coming days. And in Hong Kong, scores of people turned out for a memorial for a Chinese doctor who died from the novel coronavirus in Wuhan, China. Chinese officials say Dr. Li Wenliang, 34, an ophthalmologist who worked at the Wuhan Central Hospital, died early Friday after he was infected during the fight against the outbreak. Authorities arrested him after he tried to warn others of the dangers of the virus, which was first identified in Wuhan. His death has sparked outrage on social media in China and elsewhere. For more on what is happening in Hong Kong amid the outbreak, I spoke earlier today to journalist Verna Yu in Hong Kong.
People are getting a bit panicky. You see, we've had in the past half a year since June last year, it's been a lot of upheaval for everyone because of the protests. With the Chinese New Year, people were really hoping that this will be a calmer, more normal time. And people are really quite unprepared for this yet another wave of uncertainty. So it's a very strange situation. All the schools have closed for at least a month. People have been told to stay at home. We've run out of surgical masks. We've run out of disinfectant, alcoholic wipes. I mean, as soon as the stock come in, then it's completely wiped out. And there are long queues of people, you know, queuing up any shops which announce that we have a new stock in. And long, long lines forming. And on Tuesday night, there was a warehouse that announced online that we've got a new shipment of surgical masks from Dubai. And thousands of people queued up overnight, camped out overnight in the cold wind, which kind of defeats the whole point of trying to stop yourself from getting ill.
I don't know if it should be called a strike or not, but can you talk about the situation of the health workers who some of them have downed their tools in protest? What's going on with that?
Well, you see, the anger is about the government not closing its borders with China. There has been a steady stream of mainland Chinese coming into Hong Kong to seek treatment. Number one, they believe Hong Kong can give them better treatment, and Hong Kong also offers most of the medical treatment for free to start with. And the health workers, I think quite rightly so, felt quite fed up with the mainland visitors who are coming here to seek health treatment because they are already overloaded. They said, we don't mind treating people who already live here, but to have to deal with a stream of visitors who are, you know, sick with this pneumonia is too much. So they're angry because the Hong Kong government, until this week really, didn't close most of the borders. There are still three borders which are open. And they were also striking over the lack of adequate medical supplies, protective clothing, and they feel, why should we expose our health to risk when the government is not really doing its best to ensure the health for the health workers.
And is that strike still ongoing?
They have been striking for 5 days. Today, they have decided to go back to work.
One of the first doctors in Wuhan who spoke out about the coronavirus then was actually reprimanded for speaking out, has died.
This doctor was 34 years old, and he warned his alumni group on a messaging app in late December that 7 workers from a local market have been diagnosed with an illness that was similar to the SARS epidemic that has gone around the world in 2003. And he said that those 7 workers from the market had been quarantined in his hospital. And shortly after that, just a few days after that, the police detained him and accused him of spreading false rumors online and censured him and forced him to sign a very humiliating statement to admit that he has breached the law, he has seriously disrupted social order, and if you carry on, we will charge you. He is only one of 8 people who were detained by the police in Wuhan for spreading rumors. There's been an outpour of intense anger and grief in China because people just feel that he was a doctor with a conscience, and he has put himself out. He has tried to warn other people about this virus, and had the authorities tried to act on that piece of information rather than detaining him, shutting him up, then we wouldn't have this epidemic, which has killed more than 600 people in China now. Also in Hong Kong, people feel even more resentful towards the Chinese government.
That was journalist Verna Yu in Hong Kong. Now, also related to the coronavirus, a vast transportation lockdown meant to contain the disease's spread in China has forced many North Koreans seeking to flee their repressive country to delay their plans. This development comes as the number of North Korean defectors to South Korea has already dramatically declined. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, South Korea.
China has implemented what one World Health Organization official called an unprecedented lockdown to contain the outbreak of the new coronavirus. However, the roadblocks, mandatory temperature and ID checks, and other restrictions are disrupting the main path through which North Koreans escape. Sokil Park is with the NGO Liberty in North Korea.
Right now, we're seeing a massive slowdown in the flow of North Korean refugees, not just people traveling through China, but actually being able to escape from North Korea as well.
The lockdown has forced at least dozens of North Korean refugees in China to indefinitely pause their journeys, according to 2 sources who help arrange defector trips. Many more may be prevented from leaving because of increased virus-related patrols on the North Korean side of the border. The most common defector route is 5,000 kilometers long, from North Korea down through China and then on to Southeast Asia, before ending up in South Korea. While it's possible that China's focus on the coronavirus could create loopholes for defectors and brokers, so far Park says that does not appear to be happening.
As far as we know, so far it's been problematic in terms of the kind of routes that North Korean refugees use and being able to leave the places that they live in at the moment in order to actually start that journey, because there are increased checks going into and out of villages, towns, cities, and so on.
North Korean refugees in China are extremely vulnerable. China does not grant them refugee status. Instead, it returns them home, where they could face torture or long prison sentences. North Korean refugee Ju Chanyang knows the dangers firsthand. She was temporarily detained in China while fleeing in 2011. Ju says plainclothes police cracked down on her shelter. She thought she was being sent back to North Korea, But it turns out her parents had given a big enough bribe to let her go. Zhu also took the Southeast Asia route, which she says has now become more dangerous. She says North Korea now orders on-the-spot shooting if anyone tries to cross the river, and that both escapees and those helping them are risking their lives. According to South Korea's official statistics, just over 1,000 North Koreans defected to the South in 2019, an 18-year low. Depending on how long China's coronavirus lockdown lasts, that number could drop even further in 2020. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
You're listening to VOA News. I'm Jason Patinkin.
On Issues in the News, listen to a panel of prominent Washington journalists as they deliberate the latest top stories of the week that include the acquittal of President Trump on two articles of impeachment. Join moderator Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, panelists Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Listen Saturday and Sunday.
This is International Edition. The Academy Awards are this weekend, and VOA's Jackson Vunganyi is in Los Angeles, mingling with Hollywood's brightest stars. I talked to him earlier today, and here's what he says about the latest Oscar buzz.
The latest buzz in Hollywood is that the Oscars are taking place this Sunday at the Dolby Theater here in Hollywood. This is going to be the first Oscars award ceremony of the decade, the 92nd Oscars. It is important in a number of ways. First of all, the global audience of the Oscars has grown, and they're estimating it to be between 30 to 50 million viewers. And if you factor in online viewers and consumers of other digital products that are related to the Oscars, that brings it at least to 100 million viewers. So that's pretty big. So we are waiting to see who wins this year's major prizes: best actor, best director, best film. There's excitement around the film Parasite by a Korean director. There's buzz around other actors and actresses, including Cynthia Erivo, who is a Nigerian British actress. She has been nominated for her movie Harriet. So we are out here waiting. I'm not very far away from the red carpet. I'm still in my hotel room, but I'll be going to the red carpet. I was there yesterday. They were still doing some construction. There are some green columns that have been incorporated in the design. Stage management decided that they wanted to spotlight the issue of climate change, which is part of the larger global conversation. So if you're walking on the red carpet, stars or movie stars will be seeing these huge green columns as part of the red carpet. There are so many parties that are connected to the Oscars. Essence magazine had its own party yesterday on Thursday, where they brought, women, female filmmakers, black female filmmakers. There are other parties that are held by studios to try to bring support to their movies and celebrate their achievements and the nominations.
So this year there's some controversy over the lack of diversity in the nominees. Can you explain what's happening with that?
So the Academy has really expanded its roster, its membership over the last couple of years in response to this criticism that it is largely white and male. And so it responded by adding thousands of new members. I think around 9,000 members were added, but most of them are still, when you look at the membership overall, it's still largely male. It's still largely white, only 31% female and around 15% racial minorities. So it still has a long way to go. But if you do look at some of the movies that were nominated, including Parasite from South Korea, the first foreign film to be nominated for Best Picture, there's a lot of excitement there that it could make history as the first foreign film to win Best Picture. And I think that's some of the things that our Academy members are saying, hey, look at this. If we're not as diverse, how would we nominate a foreign movie for this much coveted award? Cynthia Erivo, who is Nigerian-British, is nominated for her role in Harriet, the movie about Harriet Tubman. If she does win, she's slated to be the youngest EGOT. That means a person who has won both the Emmy, the Grammys, the Oscars, and the Tonys, those four major awards. And so there's a lot of excitement and buzz around that. There were obviously other great actors and actresses of color that were not reflected, and so there's a lot of backlash this year at the Oscars' lack of diversity.
That was VOA's Jackson Vunganyi in Los Angeles. Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia agreed to finish talks next week on the construction of Ethiopia's Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. The three countries already agreed on a plan to fill the dam in stages and to deal with droughts and years of water scarcity while the dam fills up. Earlier, Egypt had blocked an agreement over concerns the dam would cut off its access to water from the Nile, while Ethiopia says the dam is necessary to produce electricity. For more, VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Ambassador Mohamed Higazi, a former assistant to the Egyptian foreign minister and an expert on the Nile Basin.
I think this, among the other remaining points, will settle the question for good. And I'm waiting for the suggested meeting on the 13th and the 14th of this month. And this will definitely bring us to the final stage where legal agreement should be signed between the parties. This will settle definitely Egypt's worries, and it will help also creating the expected regional development approach to see the region moving further and moving up from a nationalistic limited point of view to a larger regional approach where the three dams can be harmonized together as the agreement stipulates.
But some Egyptian analysts expressed some concerns about loose language that could open the door for possible disagreements. Is that a valid argument?
If the three parties understood the importance of cooperation for them and how water can be a cooperative framework, or how can water be a reason of coordination. So the language used is quite sufficient from a technical and legal point of view. The political willingness of the three countries, I'm sure, are there. The third party intervention, I mean the United States, up till President Trump's interest in following up the file himself and meeting the parties, all are indications that really suggest that we have to trust each other, because out of many years of studying the river and comparing the integrated approach of planning to all international rivers, one can really not only dream of seeing a scheme of cooperation, as the Treasury statement said, but a regional approach to develop. So we will have a legal binding document, and with a political support and with international supervision and with the support of the World Bank and the Treasury, introducing to the three countries a scheme of cooperation where we can link the power grids. Egypt and Sudan are very close to complete their power grids. Why not with the Renaissance Dam, which electricity can be used in the markets of Sudan and Egypt and then exported to the regional Gulf market or further to Europe. We can talk about roadways and railways as well. So Ethiopia, as a landlocked country, can use the Mediterranean ports of Egypt in Alexandria and elsewhere. One has to be cautiously optimistic. However, all indications to me is that if we want to help the river ecosystem, if we want to help the people economies in the three countries, we have to embark on a regional framework where water security will not be decided by national aspiration only, but regional aspiration. Maybe welcome such efforts and hope the three countries will sign by the end of the month an agreement, a legal binding agreement, which will settle all the worries of all parties. And it will respect the right of Ethiopia to develop the Nile and for Sudan to regulate the river and for Egypt to maintain its historic right in water.
That was Ambassador Mohamed Higazi, former assistant to the Egyptian foreign minister, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. That's it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, I'm Jason Patinkin, and thank you very much for listening. Have a great weekend.
African News tonight. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha,